Awkward today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Donald Trump's first overseas trip as president is winding down, and in Europe, it hasn't been all smiles.
I think both the NATO summit and the G7 summit have been extremely uncomfortable events for Europe and maybe for Trump as well.
Also, the Obama White House used to share intimate portraits of the president. Trump's staff prefers wider shots.
This is how the White House wants us to see the presidency right now, and it's not an intimate portrait.
Plus, migrants land in Italy after a harrowing rescue at sea. Some burst into tears.
And there were some other guys who stepped off the boat, picked a blade of grass from the ground and sniffed it. It was just so happy to be on dry land and safe.
On the world. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. It is the end of a long week, a week that's been overshadowed by the violence Monday night in Manchester, England. That bombing was front and center for President Trump. When he spoke to NATO leaders in Brussels yesterday, he told them terrorism must be stopped in its tracks.
Or the horror you saw in Manchester and so many other places will continue forever.
Or maybe not forever. Later in the show, why programs that counter violent extremism at the grassroots are so useful, and what's at risk if we don't have them. But first to the other big story this week, Trump's trip. It's been a whirlwind of countries and topics. Saudi Arabia, Israel, the Vatican, NATO, and now the G7 in Sicily. There have been sword dances, awkward handshakes, and even, maybe, some light shoving. So let's start off today with the European view on Trump's trip. Vivian Walt writes for Time magazine, and she joins us now from Paris. How have European leaders responded to Trump so far?
Well, this is certainly not friendly territory for him, in as much as his trip to Saudi Arabia seemed to be characterized by leaders kind of giddily welcoming him and, you know, really going out of their way to roll out the red carpet. You might say that Europe has been exactly the opposite. People have been exceedingly wary and really in some ways quite frosty, I would say.
I mean, Donald Trump on his Twitter feed said the trip's been very successful. If you turn to European leaders, do you think they have felt the same level of success?
I would say not. I would say that the feeling on the European continent has been one of a leader that is not necessarily their friend. He had made the European Union and its supposed evils one of the main points of his campaign during the presidential election last year. And people have not forgotten that in Europe. There was an editorial today in the German news site Der Spiegel, perhaps one of the most respected news organizations in Germany, saying Donald Trump has transformed the United States into a laughing stock. And there have been multiple stories on, certainly here in France, on television and in the newspapers, just about the body language between Trump and the European leaders, which at times has not been good.
Vivian, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about some of these odd photo ops, like the Trump family photo with the Pope at the Vatican, which we'll discuss in a moment on the show, or that lingering handshake with Emmanuel Macron. Then there's that scene in which Trump pushed his Montenegrin counterpart aside to get to the front of the line. What's been European reaction at this human level?
Well, I think certainly the video of Trump appearing to, you know, displace the Montenegrin prime minister, the leader of one of the smallest territories in the European Union, really caught people's attention. And in fact, I did see the tweet from J.K. Rowling, the author of Harry Potter books, saying, "You small, small, small man." And that seemed to be echoed in a number of the news outlets, which picked up the video and remarked about it at quite some length. The handshake, yes, it did get certainly a lot of attention. I personally, speaking for myself, did not see anything particularly wrong with the handshake. It was an extended photo op after all. But certainly there were so many different moments at which the body language alone could go terribly wrong. And perhaps the more telling one was of President Macron walking towards a group of leaders and appearing to head straight for Donald Trump and at the last moment swerving right to shake Angela Merkel's hand and then a few other people's hand before he finally reached Donald Trump, as if to make clear that in his mind, President Trump was just another one of these leaders.
When Europeans see Trump being boorish and uncouth, shoving leaders out of the way during a photo op, do they understand that for many Americans, he's delivering on promises he made during the campaign that, you know, he wants to snub the establishment, that this is why he was elected?
I think that Europeans do understand that Donald Trump certainly got millions and millions of votes. However, I think that it has been very dismaying to a lot of Europeans that somebody who appeared to not just have different policies, for example, as George W. Bush did, but who appeared to question some fundamental tenets of Western democracy, for example, the existence of the European Union and its the primacy of NATO and so on, that Americans could back somebody like that was maybe not just dismaying, but also really quite worrying. And as one French journalist told me right after the victory of Emmanuel Macron, certainly among French people, there was a sense that perhaps after 70 years, they couldn't be sure that the US would always be 100% on their side, and that they therefore realized that Europe just had to stick together or otherwise they would simply be doomed.
So quick week recap, Vivian, a good week for Trump, a good week for Europe. Whose stock is on the rise right now?
I think the jury is out on this one. I think that certainly both the NATO summit and the G7 summit have been extremely uncomfortable events for Europe and maybe for Trump as well, despite what the White House says as having been a big success. I think they are going to have to catch their breath and try work through these issues of climate, terrorism, trade deals, the European Union, all sorts of issues on which they stand at odds in a lot of respects.
That was Time Magazine's Vivian Wald speaking with us from Paris. There have been several awkward moments caught on camera during President Trump's first trip abroad. That photo of the president, Melania, and Ivanka standing next to the Pope at the Vatican, for example. Melania and Ivanka are in black veils. Trump looks effusive. The Pope, glum. Total red meat for the internet age. Almost instantly, amusing riffs on the picture appeared online featuring Photoshop characters that just seemed to fit right in, like Damien from the horror film The Omen or the spooky twin girls from The Shining. And now those have become the images people remember from Trump's meeting with the Pope. John Berdar is the author of The President's Photographer, 50 Years Inside the Oval Office. He's also the head of national programming here at WGBH. So in the case of that Trump-Pope photo, I mean, it was taken by an AP photographer, Evan Vucci. Trump does have an official White House photographer, but when presidents make overseas trips, wouldn't they try and take that official photographer to control the message?
Yeah, and they have. By my reckoning, there are three official White House photographers on this trip. There have been other photos. They tend to be fairly ceremonial photographs. I haven't really seen a lot of intimate shots. You know, we get used to these photographs that the Obama administration had, especially at the end, where there was a very well-developed relationship between the president's chief official photographer and the first family.
Yeah, talk a bit about President Obama's kind of tendency to use the White House photographer Pete Souza, because it was about access. Pete Souza got great access. What about other photographers? What kind of access did they get?
It's kind of been an evolving thing. The whole idea of a chief White House photographer officially got started under LBJ. Johnson hired a guy who basically established the gold standard, a photographer named Yoichi Okamoto. You know, the relationship between the photographer and the president is what has always defined just how intimate the photos will be. Okamoto was one of only two people in the Johnson administration who could walk into the Oval Office unannounced at any time. And that's unbelievable access. But somebody like Ollie Atkins, who was Nixon's photographer, you can tell he clearly did not have an intimate relationship with the president. He was not comfortable with photographers. And if you look at the history of the Nixon administration through the photo archive, that really shows.
What other countries try to manage the visual narrative of the head of state so closely?
Well, I can't really answer that question because I don't have any firsthand experience with it. What's interesting to me is, you know, there are certain protocols when a foreign head of state or dignitaries are visiting the White House. They often have a photographer with them.
Well, let me ask you about a recent flap involving a Russian photo of Trump's meeting with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and Russian Ambassador to the U.S. Sergei Kislyak. That photo became the defining photo of that meeting at the White House, and it wasn't the White House photographer.
Yeah, that's such an interesting situation. I mean, of course, I don't know exactly what happened, but it would be very uncharacteristic for the White House to not have had the official photographer there. And I understand that there was an official photographer there. It was atypical from a historical perspective for the White House not to control that image, especially for a group that's very image savvy. It was surprising.
Do you think the seeming lack of interest in the narrative, visual narrative, also is part of Trump's shirking Washington business as usual?
I don't think we have an archive built yet that tells us much more than they are just starting. You know, what's interesting, Marco, is that almost every previous chief photographer has had a relationship with the president before they took office. Pete Souza was working for the Chicago Tribune and covered then-Senator Barack Obama on a trip to Russia. Well, they got to know each other really well then. So that when Souza began, they already kind of knew each other. And about, you know, I would say 9 months after that, we're interviewing the president for the book and for the film. And he said, you know, at this point, Pete and I are kind of like an old married couple.
Do you know if there's any evidence that media are choking out the official photos in deference to kind of the more awkward shots? Because, I mean, Trump's base believes the media's got it in for him.
You have to be a pretty avid consumer to get a broader portrait. So, like, when I saw the memed photo of the president at the Vatican with Pope Francis, you know, I started looking around. And, you know, there was some other coverage, too, like you know, I think CNN had something in there which said, hey, look, here's the memed photo, but here's some other photos where, you know, the president is actually smiling with Pope Francis.
Right.
And it is kind of interesting. It's DIY caricature and satire. And, you know, I think that's just part of the kind of digital first world we're living in.
What's your favorite image of Trump so far based on what it says about the role of the photographer who's supposed to document a leader?
It'll be weird that my favorite is not what I would consider a very good photograph, but it's one of these really formal, extremely wide shots taken somewhere in, you know, in the Saudi king's kind of royal receiving room. That's a favorite because it is saying, okay, this is how the White House wants us to see the presidency right now. And it's not an intimate portrait. It's a very official kind of, okay, this is a ceremonial scene and this is what the president is doing right now. I like that because it's telling us a lot of information about, you know, where the White House is right now.
John Berdara, the author of The President's Photographer, 50 Years Inside the Oval Office. He's also head of national programming right here at WGBH in Boston. John, thanks so much.
You bet, Marco. My pleasure.
Coming up, budget cuts threaten a program designed to counter violent extremism. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Manchester has been in our thoughts a lot this week after the bombing there on Monday that killed 22 people. The city's first responders have been praised for their work. And today, the UK's Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn gave a political speech in which he came down hard on recent cuts to Britain's emergency services and police.
Austerity has to stop at the accident and emergency ward and at the police station door. We cannot be protected and cared for on the cheap.
Since the bombing at that Ariana Grande concert in Manchester, it's come to light that the community had previously reported the bomber to British authorities as someone who was possibly radicalized, reported him several times, in fact. The concept of the whole community keeping an eye out for people at risk of radicalization, that's something the U.S. has been working on for a decade through a program called Countering Violent Extremism, or CVE. And this week, President Trump proposed cutting the program. Farah Pandith is one of the architects of CVE. The World's Rupa Shenoy spoke with her.
Would you mind doing a history of the Countering Violent Extremism program?
Countering Violent Extremism is a term that was formed in 2006. when the national security strategy was written for President Bush. And in that security strategy, he talked about needing to not just have a battle of arms, but a battle of ideas. And that's critical because that ideological component speaks directly to how young people are getting radicalized. So that whole field of stopping radicalization from happening, meaning how do you persuade a young person not to find the ideology of extremist groups interesting, is what countering violent extremism is. So this is not law enforcement. This is not advocacy. This is about building up influential voices that can speak directly to the issue of ideology so that young people will not go on a path that connects them to violence.
I was reading about the cut of funding to the CVE program by the Trump administration in their proposed budget. And then there was this Manchester bombing. And it's been reported that the authorities were previously contacted about the bomber. And it struck me that the CVE program kind of aims to do that in the U.S., aims to work with communities to identify possibly radicalized people and bring them forward. Is that a fair line to draw, a fair comparison to make?
It is critical to understand that local communities are actually seeing and hearing things first. When a young person begins to act differently, think differently, behave differently, it is oftentimes people within the home and then within the neighborhood and their peer group that begin to see those changes. That's why it's so important to actually build bridges with local communities and to understand what's happening at the local level.
So it sounds like you're saying yes, that this is the U.S. program that would attempt to identify individuals like the bomber in Manchester. The nature of this program, though, it probably makes it really tough to show results, right? The criticism from Republicans is that we should be focusing on law enforcement, not community outreach. So is there a way to show that this program is having an impact?
The mistake that's been made by both Democrats and Republicans has been that they believe that there has to be some metric that is the end-all be-all for demonstrating that they've made everybody safe. And I think it's a problematic frame from which to assess. What policymakers want to know is, if I just give them this, I'll get something else in return and I can measure that and therefore the program is fine. These are very complicated things. It's very mushy, and policymakers are not good with mush. They don't like to have to get into an emotional space. That's not something that they're ever used to. But the fact of the matter is, we have looked at the issue of ideology. We have begun to see how we can persuade a change in behavior and a change of thinking. And you have to be comfortable with seeding a lot of different things and saying that if I want to defeat ISIS, I know that I need to stop the recruitment from happening. And that's going to mean a 5 to 10 year commitment with resources at scale to see what happens and to have that kind of nuance and that movability along the way to be able to change the programs to move along with what the bad guys are doing. And only then, I would argue, after we've done things for a couple of years at scale, can we begin to see if we're having an impact.
Under the Obama administration, the Countering Violent Extremism program was focused on reducing all forms of extremism, including efforts to de-radicalize white supremacists. And reportedly, the Trump administration at one point was thinking about focusing the program, narrowing it, and actually renaming it Countering Islamic Extremism. In your opinion, would that be better than just cutting this program?
We have to understand that what's happening to young kids is not an isolated experience. When you have a rise in anti-Semitism or a rise in Holocaust denial in Europe, it directly impacts the way other communities are feeling about themselves and what it means to be who they are. So this idea of eliminating hate has to be all-encompassing. It cannot just be one kind of extremism that you're looking at. It is no accident that there is an increase in far-right movements and expression at the same time that there is an increase in people being interested in groups like ISIS. Things are connected. Experience is connected. What we have to do is to push back against the rise of hate globally in all forms, and we have to invest in local solutions. And I would argue that no government on earth has made this the kind of priority they should.
There were ongoing concerns from some in Muslim communities this whole time that the CVE program was actually being used as a way to surveil people without just cause. And also people said it was turning community members against each other, causing suspicion. So in a way, could cutting the program be a good thing for some of these communities? Could it get a good response?
You know, in the last few years, there has been a lot of effort and time and energy placed into fight against the efforts to prevent people from getting radicalized because it's called CVE. So let's take that name off the table. And let me just say, even if you called it, you know, unicorns and rainbows and asked communities, do you want efforts to make sure that we are protecting your young people, I would find it very surprising if communities would say we don't want to do anything to protect our young people from being lured in from extremist groups like ISIS. And that's what countering violent extremism is. It's fighting the ideology of extremist groups, in this case, in the defeat of ISIS, and making sure that they don't have new troops that are joining their ranks, and they're not inspiring things that are happening like Manchester, because young people are getting lured in new ways. You have to fight that. It isn't all right to sit back. It is our responsibility to protect our youth and to find ways in a natural, organic system within communities and neighborhoods to make sure that these young people are protected. And that's what this is.
Farah Pandith helped develop the U.S. government's Countering Violent Extremism program. She was speaking there with my colleague Rupa Shenoy. You can hear a longer version of that interview on Rupa's podcast. It's called Otherhood, and you can find it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Marco Werman. A teenage boy in El Salvador chose not to join a gang. Now he's hiding from gang members who say they want to kill him.
He's been inside my apartment for 1 year now. He only goes out onto the patio. He doesn't have any freedom.
His story and how the U.S. could help him, that's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. For the past 3 weeks, the world's Richard Hall has been on board the Vos Hestia in the Mediterranean, a ship that has one mission right now, rescuing migrants at sea.
It really has been an incredibly eye-opening journey to witness this thing firsthand and see just how dangerous the seas are out there.
On Tuesday, the ship, run by Save the Children, picked up more than 600 people from a cluster of inflatable rafts and dinghies. Thousands of people make this leap of faith every year. They climb aboard these little boats along the dangerous shores of North Africa, hoping to reach Europe. Today, the Vos Hestia docked in Italy and delivered the rescued migrants safely on shore. I asked Richard to tell me about one of the migrants he met on the boat, a man named Jackson from Liberia.
He left Liberia a couple of years ago and came to Libya. And his story is actually similar to most of the people you speak to on the boat. Many of them came to Libya trying to look for work, not trying to get to Europe especially, but trying to look for work and trying to build a better life for themselves. And they had no idea of the situation there. So when Jackson got to Libya, he was caught up in this horrible civil war, and he was arrested and he was detained for 2 months.
So after being in Libya, he gets on this boat. He's one of the ones who was rescued. Let's hear what that was like.
When you were on the boat, were you afraid that it might sink?
Yes, I was afraid. I was afraid because I don't know where I'm going. I don't even know where I'm going. But when somebody told me that this is international water, and I saw Save the Children, I knew that United Nations were ahead of me. I shed tears. It was the tears of joy and sorrow that came to my mind.
Yeah, Save the Children in the UN equated tears of joy. What about fatalities, Rich? How many people were unable to be rescued, or is that a hard question to answer?
On that day, thankfully, no one died in the sea. But it was a sad day the next day. In the very same stretch of water, more than 30 people drowned, and most of them were toddlers. And that's one of the things that struck me on the way back. I was sitting there on the deck looking out at all these people on the boat. The boat was packed to the rafters. This boat was only meant to hold 400 people. And I was just looking at all these faces and just trying to imagine how different it could have been. if not for a stroke of luck. If they'd have chosen a different day to go out on their boats, they might not have been there.
And yet some encouraging glimmers. There's this moment of joy, this other picture video on your Instagram feed as people start breaking out in song. So these singers are from Ivory Coast. There are a lot of different nationalities singing, right? Everybody kind of taking a turn.
It was an amazing moment, honestly. So we heard people singing from the bow of the boat at the front of the boat. We just heard them from the other side of the ship. And so we rushed over there, and there was a crowd of people from countries all around the world. You had people from the Ivory Coast, people from Nigeria, people from Bangladesh. They were all gathered in a circle, and they were taking turns to sing songs from their homeland. Each group would pick a song between them, and then they just burst out, and they would all applaud each other. It was really a wonderful moment, and it just goes to show the resilience of these people that are making this journey.
So now that these passengers are on the other side of the Mediterranean, tell us about some of the emotion you've witnessed of the disembarkation, because a bond has got to develop between rescuers and the rescued, not to mention among the travelers themselves who have worked together to get across this sea.
Yeah, today was really incredibly moving and poignant. It was, even for me as a journalist, you know, you talk to these people, you come into their lives for a short period of time, and you hear their stories, and for the staff as well, you're with them at this really dramatic moment in their life. This isn't just interviewing someone and saying goodbye. You're with them at this moment. And so there are bonds developed between the staff on the ship here and the people. So today when they had to say goodbye to them, it was incredibly moving. You saw there were some people that were scared. There was one woman waiting in line to get off the boat who burst into tears because she was so nervous about what came next. And there were some other guys who stepped off the boat, picked a blade of grass from the ground and sniffed it. It was just so happy to be on dry land and safe. But yeah, it's an incredible thing to witness, this roller coaster of emotions for everyone on board this ship.
The world's Richard Hall aboard the Vos Hestia, a rescue ship now in southern Italy. Rich, thanks so much for spending this time on the ship. We've really learned a lot.
Thanks very much, Marco. It's my pleasure.
Richard's taken some great photographs that capture the drama of life aboard the rescue boat. You can see them at PRI.org. All this week, our Across Women's Lives project has been bringing you stories about trafficking, women who are bought, stolen, and sold. We've looked at how some of those women escape and try to move on with their lives. And while our focus has been on Uganda, trafficking also happens a lot closer to home. In the final story of our series, the world's Jasmine Garst uncovers a family secret.
A couple of months ago, a friend of mine reached out to me. It was about her grandmother, Frances. Grandma Frances is 85 years old, and my friend told me, Grandma says she has a story she needs to tell someone. Can you please come by? So I headed over to their house.
Come in!
That's Grandma Frances. She's tiny and very thin, with a shock of white hair and brown eyes that are always smiling, even when she isn't. She talks in that loud Queen's accent that sounds like she's chewing on the words before she speaks them.
All the conversations that I used to belong.
But secrets have a language of their own, and Grandma Frances insists she will only tell me this story in her native tongue, Spanish.
Yo crecí en Jalisco, sí.
She isn't actually from Queens. She was born Francisca Carmona García in Jalisco, Mexico. And when she speaks about Jalisco, her eyes light up.
El hombre tapatío.
The men are handsome there, she gushes. They ride their horses with a gun on their side. You're blushing, I tell her.
Yeah, I know.
I ask her what her favorite childhood memory is, and she says, leaving. Francisca's family was very poor.
Porque a veces, en esos tiempos, no había mucho que comer.
We ate seeds and tortillas with some chile, and it tasted good because we were hungry. She tells me her little sister died of starvation. So when she was 14 years old, Francisca left home to go to Guadalajara. She got a job as a maid and started sending money home. But money was still tight, and Francisca had bigger dreams.
Norte.
El Norte, the North, America. It was the 1950s, the decade of prosperity and U.S. cultural expansion. Rock and roll was born. Marilyn Monroe sang breathlessly about diamonds, her best friend. John Wayne was flying airplanes, and Marlon Brando was riding a streetcar named Desire. Francisca got her big break one day when she was 16 while she was working. An older woman approached her and said,
"Necesitaban muchas muchachas para que trabajaran."
"We're looking for waitresses right on the border with Texas, a tiny town called Villacuña, at a restaurant called
La Perla."
La Perla, the pearl. Francisca packed up and headed there to her new job waiting tables. It was about a day's travel. But when she finally got to this town, well, there wasn't a restaurant. She says there weren't even streets, really. The Pearl was a house in the dusty middle of nowhere.
Era una casa de mujeres.
It was a brothel.
Uno tiene que hacer lo que tiene que hacer.
"You gotta do what you gotta do," she says, resigned. She never imagined this would happen to her, and she didn't have a choice now. "I was the breadwinner in my family," she explains, "and she was a kid. This all happened when she was a teenager." They gave us our room and told us to dress very pretty and go out to the salon because it was full of American soldiers. The brothel, she tells me, exclusively served the American military, who came in from across the border in Texas. Mexican men didn't set foot in the Pearl, but the Mexican police protected the place and watched over the girls. And once a month, Francisca says,
"Los doctores venían cada mes."
The doctors would come give us checkups. It's strange hearing this sweet little grandma tell me the tale of how she was trafficked while she insists that I finish a giant plate of tamales she made for me. But none of this is unusual. Mexican border towns have always served as places of vice and exploitation. Sex tourism is a lucrative business, and even to this day, girls like Francisca are being trafficked throughout Mexico. Between 2011 and 2012, authorities reported that over 9,000 women have gone missing. And that's just the reported cases.
Y muy bonita ella, pero era muy buena con nosotros.
But Francisca doesn't tell her story like other trafficking survivors I've spoken to. She talks about how lucky she was. A friend of hers who got taken to another town, she was killed. Francisca talks about a very kind, gorgeous madam who let her keep some of the money she earned. Important men in uniform who were gentlemanly. I leave her house feeling a bit perplexed by this. But her tone shifts the next time we talk, when she invites me over for lunch. And that's when, as she ladles a thick oxtail soup on my plate, she tells me, "You know, this is a great shame in my life. I want you to understand I was desperate."
Es una vida muy fea. Fea porque...
It's an ugly thing, she tells me. You have relations with a man you don't want. You just close your eyes and you let it happen. It's false. You do it out of necessity, not desire. You know nothing about love. You know nothing about kissing with passion. I ask if she's angry, and she pauses and responds, "Yeah, at myself." So I ask her, "Why are you telling me this secret? Why now? Why ever?"
¿Y por qué?
Yo no sé por qué. Yo creo que había algo aquí por dentro.
"I don't know. I don't know why," she says. "I think there was something here," and she rubs her narrow chest, "something inside of me." Francisca does know how much she wanted to leave that place. She says she always told herself,
"Pero yo siempre dije,
I gotta marry an American."
Tengo que casarme.
So one day, this customer came in. He was tall and handsome, a sergeant in the U.S. Air Force.
Se llamaba William.
His name was William.
Un soldado muy elegante.
He was so elegant. He was wearing a blue shirt and a tie. He was almost 6 feet tall. And that night, they took a walk.
Y la luna estaba bien bonita.
And the moon was beautiful. And he fell in love with me. And then he said, "I want you to get out of here." Okay, Maybe you, the listener, are wondering the same thing I did. Did they really fall in love? Does a teenager who is trapped and needs so much to get out of where she is truly love the one man who can rescue her, a customer at the brothel? And every time I asked, she replied the same.
Yo me enamoré de él.
I fell in love with him. I loved that man. William married her and brought her here, to New York. They came by bus. It was 1952. This is exactly where they arrived. Port Authority, Manhattan's hectic, congested central bus station. I meet her here early on a Saturday.
Francis! Hi!
She's eager to take me to her neighborhood in Queens and introduce me to all her friends. She switches back to English.
Oh my goodness, Jasmine, good to see you. Okay, we're gonna take the A train. This is my neighborhood. This is my neighborhood now.
This is Queens. She says the first time she got here,
we took a taxi to the house, to my mother-in-law's house. Yes.
It was 4 a.m. It was dark, and she couldn't see anything. She didn't know back then that everything was going to be okay, that she'd be part of a big family who adored her, that her husband would take her to the movies.
There used to be a movie over there.
To see all the big stars she loved on the big screen.
My favorite actor, Ronald Reagan and Burt Lancaster. Oh, I thought it was a wonderful, wonderful actor.
Here's what she did know back then, the night she arrived in Queens, while her new husband knocked on his family's door. Something really bad had happened to her. Something that happens to women all the time. Still, to this day. A secret she would think about sometimes, but would never tell anyone about. Not for another 60 years or so, as a widow with grandchildren. And she knew that she'd been able to survive it. She'd been able to get out. And now, she was going to build something else. A beautiful life.
Francis, come in.
Francisca Carmona Garcia, better known to the many people who love her as Frances, was finally home. For the World, I'm Jasmine Garst, Queens, New York.
For the past 2 weeks, we've been reporting on the impact human trafficking has on women and girls around the world. Now we want to hear your stories. Has trafficking affected you or your community, and how? Tell us what you've seen on Facebook. Just head to Facebook and search for Across Women's Lives. There are so many people who flee their homes as refugees because staying where they are is risky, even possibly deadly. Take El Salvador. You've got rampant gang violence, and recruitment starts young. When kids say they don't want to join, gangs often threaten to kill them. That's led to tens of thousands of children going into hiding or fleeing. After some pretty harrowing journeys, many of them arrive at the U.S. border. In December 2014, the Obama administration rolled out a program called Central American Minors. The idea was to give young people the option of requesting asylum in the U.S. before they leave their home countries, meaning they could have their case heard without having to make the dangerous trek north. But the program was temporarily halted when President Trump issued his executive order stopping all refugee processing. From San Salvador, Tipa Fernandez picks up the story.
Ana Riva was at work one day in 2015 when she got an urgent call from her nephew, Juan, who she'd raised since his mother left for the US years ago. It was a moment she'd so far avoided with Juan. But now, here it was. He was 16, and a local gang had him surrounded, insisting he join.
They demanded money when they threatened him. They wanted him to pay a sum of money immediately. He called me, all scared. I mean, they had guns to his head.
She left work immediately and called other relatives to help.
We had to get him out of that place because he received a death threat. He was told he had to join the gang or they would kill him.
We aren't using Juan's real name or his aunt's real name, as the gangs already found him once where he was sent to hide. Now he's hiding inside his aunt's apartment, and they're very scared he'll be discovered.
He's been inside my apartment for 1 year now. He only goes out onto the patio. He doesn't have any freedom. If he gets sick, I have to hide him and take him out.
the family initially decided Juan should trek north to the US. They thought he would have a good chance at gaining asylum, and his mother would be there to receive him. But he only made it as far as Mexico, where he was picked up and sent back to San Salvador by Mexican authorities. It was a harrowing experience, his aunt says. That's when Juan went into hiding inside her apartment and applied for asylum to the United States through the Central American Miners Program, or CAM.
So the idea behind CAM was to provide a safe and legal alternative to that journey and allow children to apply for permission to live in the U.S. without ever having to leave home.
Faye Hipsman is a policy analyst with the Migration Policy Institute. CAM was an Obama administration effort aimed at decreasing the number of unaccompanied minors from Central America. While good in theory, Hipsman says, it hasn't really done much.
In 2016, the last fiscal year, 60,000 unaccompanied minors still came to the U.S., despite CAM being operational. One of the key limitations is that the program requires children to have a parent who is lawfully present in the United States. And this is an issue because the majority of immigrants in the U.S. from Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador are actually unauthorized, so the families are ineligible for the program.
And Hipsman says the program has one other big limitation. It's slow.
A recent assessment showed that average cases take 400 days, so over a year, to be processed. And for children who are in serious danger, they don't have that time to wait. They'll just leave.
According to a State Department spokesperson, 11,000 Central American kids have applied since the program started, and just over 2,800 have been admitted and are now living in the U.S., though many of them only received a temporary visa. Yet advocates worry that many vulnerable kids are still being left out.
Me pareció muy arbitrario todo.
Completely arbitrary. That's Marina Ortiz's critique of how CAM is working on the ground. She's a Salvadoran immigration and human rights attorney who's helped many scared youth find a route to safety. She's seen some young people successfully win entry to the U.S. using the CAM program, but the one client she pursued a CAM case for was rejected by the U.S. ambassador.
The consulate is obligated to review all the documents and tell us why my client didn't qualify, why my client was not eligible, but nothing. They didn't tell us anything.
El Salvador remains one of the most deadly countries in the world, especially for young people threatened by gangs, and fleeing the country is the only option for many of these kids. So it was with alarm that the leftist FMLN government watched as newly elected U.S. President Donald Trump tried to stop all refugees entering the U.S. The CAM program stopped too, until the court halted Trump's executive order. All this worries Salvadoran government officials, like Aquiles Magaña, who runs a government agency that deals with issues of migration.
Remember, we have a very unpredictable president in the United States, and we don't know for how long he's going to be sustaining this harassment against communities.
Faye Hipsman of the Migration Policy Institute says the Salvadoran government is right to be worried about the Trump administration possibly ending CAM.
The program is absolutely on the administration's radar. There was a lot of opposition to CAM initially from members of Congress, and many of the people on the Hill who were critics of the CAM program when it was launched are in the Trump administration today.
In other words, hardliners worried CAM would encourage the very kind of immigration they were trying to stop. One of the most outspoken senators against CAM was Jeff Sessions, who today is Trump's attorney general. Back in San Salvador, Juan is waiting to hear about his asylum prospects after his interview months ago through the CAM program, says his aunt, Ana Riva. She fears the worst if he's denied.
Nearby in my community, when young people have been threatened by gangs and they haven't had any options to escape, the gangs killed them. That's how it is here.
If Juan is denied, he can't spend the rest of his life hiding in her apartment, Riva says. Then she starts to cry. For The World, Deepa Fernandez, San Salvador.
Mexican singer Carla Morrison has recorded songs about loss and about love gone wrong. It's almost a trademark for her. There's nothing academic or scholarly about Morrison's music. It comes from the heart, with all the subtleties that go along with that. So let's close today's program with her version of a song by the Velvet Underground, a group that really knew how to create a quiet, subtle tune.
A veces me siento alegre. A veces me siento mal.
Carla Morrison's cover of Pale Blue Eyes, written by Lou Reed. A little something to get your Memorial Day weekend started. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. Enjoy your weekend, everybody. We'll be back with you on Monday.
Public Radio International.